Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The conflict in northern Ethiopia has pushed up the number of people in need of food assistance to an estimated 9.4 million, UN humanitarians said on Friday. The World Food Programme said that the Amhara region, which is seeing active fighting, has seen the largest spike, with 3.7 million people now in urgent need of help. Out of those in need across northern Ethiopia, more than 80%, nearly 8 million, are behind battle lines, WFP spokesperson Thompson Thierry told journalists in Geneva. The severity of hunger and malnutrition is frightening, Mr. Thierry explained.
We are running out of words, really, to capture exactly the situation that is unfolding before our eyes. But what I can tell you, it is the textbook definition of a humanitarian crisis.
To date, the UN agency has reached 3.2 million people with emergency food assistance across the north of the country, including 875,000 mothers and children with nutritionally fortified food in Tigray and Amhara. But it remains extremely concerned that the nutrition situation there is deteriorating fast after screening from Tigray, Amhara and Afar regions showed malnutrition rates at between 16 and 28% for children. Even more alarming, up to one in two pregnant and breastfeeding women in Amhara and Tigray were also malnourished. An alert now from UNITAID, which warned that the COVID pandemic has led to a drop in testing for HIV for the first time in more than two decades. The decline in testing and diagnosis for human immunodeficiency virus worldwide comes as the UN agency called for greater funding to support self-testing and access to treatment and prevention. From UNITAID, his spokesperson, Hervé Veussel.
With more than 37 million people living with HIV worldwide, an estimate 6 million of whom do not know the status, receiving a diagnosis is a vital first step in accessing treatment.
Although 88 countries now have self-testing policies covering the epicenter of the HIV epidemic in eastern and southern Africa, only 10% of Asian countries and 6% of Latin American nations have adopted similar measures. Self-testing is especially important in reaching people who are particularly vulnerable to HIV but who face stigmatization in their communities. These individuals include men who have sex with men, transgender individuals and sex workers. To encourage them to self-test, UNITAID has made test kits available in places they tend to visit, such as nightclubs, hotels or by face-to-face meetings. By 2025, the number of self-tests procured is projected to meet just 15% of estimated needs in low- and middle-income countries. To meet the shortfall, an additional $104 million will be required, UNITAID's Mr. Veussel said. The UN Health Agency has urged all countries to adopt a risk-based and a scientific approach to travel bans linked to a new COVID-19 variant. The development on Friday came as a World Health Organization panel prepared to meet to assess the potential impact of a new coronavirus mutation identified as B11529. It has prompted concern because early analysis show that it's undergone far more mutations than other COVID variants. But it will take a few weeks to determine whether it is likely to be more virulent and transmissible than other variants. From Geneva, here's WHO spokesperson Christian Lindmeier.
Countries can do a lot already in terms of surveillance and sequencing and work together with affected countries or globally to work scientifically to fight this variant and to understand more about it so that we know how to go about. So at this point, again, implementing travel measures is being cautioned against.
The UN Health Agency spokesperson repeated previous WHO advice that people could do a lot to protect themselves from COVID, including by continuing to wear masks and avoiding crowds. Katie Dartford, UN News.
This is Conor Lennon from UN News. Artificial intelligence systems are being used in an increasingly large range of toys, games, and educational tools targeting children, but there are few safeguards in place to protect them. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, has developed guidance to help policymakers protect children following consultations with private companies, experts, and young people. Yasmina Byrne, Policy Chief at the UNICEF Global Insights Team, and Stephen Vosloo, a UNICEF Data Research and Policy Specialist, both worked on the guidance. They explained to me that they were motivated by the huge growth of AI in everyone's lives.
we at UNICEF were seeing that AI was a very hot topic and very current and was being recognized as something that would fundamentally change society and economies and the world today and even more so in coming generations. But when we looked at the national AI strategies and even the corporate policies and guidelines that were being developed, we realized that not enough attention was being paid to child users and to children and to how AI impacts them. And not just today, but obviously that impact will grow even more. And so we started this project with the government of Finland, who's been our partner, to look at how we can develop more child-centered AI. We realized that guidance was needed to inform policies and practice. And so we developed such a guidance, which we released last year as a draft. And we went through a fairly extensive consultation process to develop that, speaking to experts around the world, adult experts, but also holding consultations with children, almost 250 children in five countries. And that led to the guidance. And after releasing it, we invited governments and organizations and companies to pilot the guidance, because it's very easy to put down AI principles. There are over 160 different principles in the world for ethical AI and responsible AI. It's much more difficult to practice that. And so we've invited anyone really to use the guidance. And we've been working with eight organizations who've been piloting the guidance, and we are developing case studies around that. So to be able to share the lessons learned of how they've applied the guidance in their particular context and with children and in their situation.
So what are you concerned that even when we're talking about a product like a toy, which is targeted towards children, that the AI used in that was not necessarily appropriate to be used with a child?
Again, it depends how it's used and what kind of protections have been put in place. So if you have an AI-enabled toy, it will be using potentially computer vision to see the child, to see the room for image or object recognition. Using natural language processing to understand words and instructions. And so it's collecting a lot of data from that child in terms of conversations. That data is being stored in the cloud often, on commercial servers, and that's a very intimate space for a child to be talking to a toy. And are there enough privacy considerations, surveillance potential considerations? Is the system secure enough? We know of instances where toys have been hacked. And so, for example, in Germany, those types of toys were banned because it just wasn't safe enough.
And you also say that children are interacting with or are impacted by AI systems that are not designed for them.
Yasmina's research with others has shown that at least one third of all online users are children. And we often get younger children using platforms that are social media platforms or video sharing platforms or even search that isn't designed for them at all. And so we really need to think about issues around privacy and around data, potential profiling of users. And I think that this is a really important point, that when any of us use these systems, that they are designed in a certain way, often for maximum engagement, and are built on a certain level of profiling based on data sets that may not represent you as a child and your particular individual characteristics. But you may be profiled in a way that puts you in a certain bucket. It may determine what kind of educational opportunities you have in the future or what benefits you can access. For children, it's really not just impacting them today, but it could set their whole life course in a different direction. And so that kind of predictive analytics and profiling is particularly relevant when dealing with children and setting their life direction.
Can you just explain what you mean by that?
So, for example, let's say there was an AI-driven educational system that is based on adaptive learning that really gets to know a child and their learning style and collects a lot of information and from that says, this child is a particular learner, X particular learner, or Y particular type of learner, and therefore these subjects or this kind of career option is best suited. But those systems are based on data sets that may not actually have data that represents all different learning styles or all different types of personality traits or learning types. And so it may not accurately actually set, you know, give an accurate reading of ability and of opportunity.
Yeah, like I remember, Steve, when I think last year there was the big news about how some schools in the UK were using this algorithm to predict the final grades of high schoolers. And because the data that was input into these algorithms was skewed towards children from private schools, the results were really appalling, and they really discriminated against a lot of children who were from minority communities. So they had to abandon that system. So that's just one of the examples how if algorithms are based on data that is biased can actually have a really negative consequences for children.
And this goes back to what you were saying before, we're not having a judgment on the technology itself, but the way it's applied. So
exactly.
Data scientists are the ones at the front line here. Is your advice, do you think, going to filter down to those people who are actually writing the code?
We really do hope so. Our policy guidance has been aimed at two broad audiences. The one is at governments and policymakers who are increasingly setting strategies for AI, but also beginning to think about regulating AI. And then there's the commercial sector, the private sector that often develops these AI systems. We hope that the guidance filters down to them. We do see competing interests and the research on in AI systems in the industry reflects this, that the decisions around AI systems often have to balance kind of a profit margin or profit kind of incentive versus an ethical one. And so what we advocate for is that it's kind of a whole organization-wide commitment to responsible AI that really comes from the top. It's not just the decision of the data scientist or the software developer at the bottom, but it really gets the support from all the way from top management or from senior government levels.
One of the things that we are particularly concerned about is commercial marketing and targeting of children for commercial purposes. The project that we were talking about today about AI, we also had another initiative on data governance where we really examined very closely how these children's personal data, their consumer data, their browsing data, their data that they the data footprint they leave by using digital technology is commercialized and used by third parties for their own profit and for their own gain. And obviously, children are often, because of this maximization of algorithms for commercial purposes, they're often targeted by ads that are not really appropriate for them. Sometimes they could be really harmful. And very often children are completely unaware that these are even ads. They think that they are like legitimately links that are provided to them to click because they liked something many times and so on. So this is something that we really closely follow and monitor. And we have to say that there is more, I would say, political appetite to address these issues and child protection and protection of personal data when it comes to children, particularly at some levels of some governments. And we are working very closely with the rest of the colleagues in our organization to actually see how we can put these issues on the agenda of policymakers.
Now, I'm sure there's no silver bullet for this, but I'll put the question to both of you. If there was one thing that you could get governments to change, what would that be?
I think I would say that really governments need to think and put children in the center of all their policymaking around frontier digital technologies to understand that this generation of children are not only, as Steve was pointing out, really avid users of these technologies, but that also they are future developers. And if we don't think about them and their needs and don't approach them in a way that they're central to all the discussions of the future of AI, then we are really missing great opportunities.
I would certainly second that point. And we've often said if child-centered AI isn't just good for children, it's good for everyone. And so recognizing, as Yasmina said, that this is a significant user base, not just today, but into the future. What we've also seen is that governments like Scotland, they released their AI strategy in March, and they officially adopted the UNICEF policy guidance on AI for children. And part of that was because the government as a whole has adopted the Convention on the Rights of the Child into law, and Sweden's done the same. And so when governments begin to put children not just in the digital space, but more broadly at the center, then the other pieces fall in. But the digital is a huge piece, given how much children's lives are not really online or offline anymore. It's just life for them, and it's a digital life.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Urgent action is needed to avoid a repeat of tragedies like the drowning of at least 27 people in the English Channel on Wednesday, the United Nations Refugee Agency has said. The incident amounted to the largest single loss of life in the English Channel since the UN Migration Agency, IOM, started recording data in 2014. Another 106 migrants were rescued in French waters on Wednesday alone. Since the start of the year, well over 31,000 have attempted the dangerous crossing between France and the UK, and 7,800 people have been rescued at sea, according to French authorities. Ever increasing numbers of people are attempting the journey in small, unseaworthy boats as they flee conflict, poverty or persecution in Afghanistan, Sudan, Iraq, Eritrea and elsewhere. UNHCR reiterated the importance of continuing to raise awareness of the risk posed by sea crossings and of the false information given by smugglers who exploit the distress of children, women and men who have left their home countries. The UN agency added that the development of legal and secure channels is crucial to safeguarding migrants' lives and, in particular, family reunification. One in five refugee or internally displaced women have faced sexual violence, and the situation continues to worsen globally, the UN Refugee Agency said on Thursday. On the 30th anniversary of the campaign for 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, the UN agency said there's been a global surge in domestic violence, child marriages, trafficking, sex exploitation and abuse since March. A lethal mix of confinement, deepening poverty and economic duress is unleashing a renewed wave of violence against refugee, displaced and stateless women and girls, it said. To tackle the crisis, the UN agency has called for funding to be scaled up for grassroots projects that focus on prevention and helping victims of gender-based violence. These include the Myanmar Ethnic Women's Refugee Organization, where refugee women have joined forces to overcome abuse, reinforcing their role as strong protectors of their families and communities. UNHCR issued the alert after recording increases in gender-based violence in at least 27 countries. In the Central African Republic, it's said that one gender-based violence incident is recorded every hour. And in Colombia, similar incidents affecting Venezuelan refugees and migrants have increased by 40% over the first three quarters of the year, the agency noted. The execution of an Iranian former young offender has been condemned by UN-appointed independent rights experts who have urged the authorities to stop sentencing children to death. Armen Abdelali was convicted of murder when he was 17. He was executed at dawn on Wednesday, the 24th of November. The date had been rescheduled at least six occasions and involved Mr. Abdelali being transferred to solitary confinement in preparation for his execution, only to be returned to his cell at the last minute. There are currently more than 85 juvenile offenders on death row in Iran whose sentences violate international human rights law, according to the rights experts. They added that the majority are from marginalised groups or are individuals who themselves have been victims of abuse. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Hello, in this week's show, an alert over fighting in Yemen's north and the inevitable toll on the country's war-weary people, grassroots solutions to gender-based violence, and the latest from the UN Health Agency about rare multi-organ inflammation in children with COVID. Stay with us too to hear about progress on the global eradication of landmines, and not forgetting closing comments from regular guest Solange Behetege-Cortez. That's all coming up in this week's UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. Thanks for listening. First, the news.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In Yemen, UN humanitarians have said that they're extremely concerned about the safety of civilians in Northern Marib Governorate, which is home to some 1 million displaced people. UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, issued the warning as the front lines of conflict shift closer to heavily populated areas in the oil-rich region. Access to humanitarian aid is also becoming harder, said UNHCR spokesperson Shavia Mantou.
Rocket strikes close to the sites hosting the displaced are causing fear and panic. The latest incident was reported on 17th of November when an artillery shell exploded without casualties near a site close to Marib City. UNHCR teams report that there is heavy fighting in the mountains surrounding the city and the sounds of explosions and planes can be heard day and night.
Yemen's people are suffering the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with more than 4 million people uprooted from their homes and over 20 million in dire need of aid relief. One in five refugee or internally displaced women have faced sexual violence, and the situation continues to worsen globally, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has warned. In conjunction with the campaign for 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, the UN agency said that there's been a global surge in domestic violence, child marriages, trafficking, sexual exploitation and abuse since March last year. A lethal mix of confinement, deepening poverty and economic duress is unleashing a renewed wave of violence against refugee, displaced and stateless women and girls, it said. To tackle the crisis, the UN agency has called for funding to be scaled up for grassroots projects that focus on prevention and helping victims of gender-based violence. These include the Myanmar Ethnic Women's Refugee Organization, where refugee women have joined forces to overcome abuse, reinforcing their role as strong protectors of their families and communities. Children who have developed organ inflammation linked to COVID-19 infection should be given steroid treatment in hospital, the World Health Organization, WHO, said this week. The UN Health Agency recommendation comes after it first described multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children associated with COVID-19, or MISC for short, last May. Here's WHO spokesperson Christian Lindmeier speaking in Geneva.
MISC is a rare but serious condition where children with COVID-19 develop inflammation affecting different organs of the body. Children with this condition need specialized care and may need to be admitted to intensive care. Although MISC is a serious condition, with the right medical care, children with this condition recover.
Mr. Lindmeier said that although youngsters remain at a low risk of developing severe or critical COVID-19, some underlying factors make them more susceptible to becoming seriously ill, such as obesity, chronic lung disease, asthma, cardiovascular disease, and immunosuppression. Mihika Acharya, UN News.
The headlines there, and now to our interview, which takes us into the lethal world of landmines and unexploded ordnance. In this year's report from the UN-backed NGO Landmine Monitor, it was found that global casualties from anti-personnel landmines were exceptionally high last year, Syrians and Afghans' worst hit. In fact, more than 7,000 people were killed or injured in 54 countries and areas in 2020, while Myanmar was the only state where it was confirmed that the weapons have been used in the last 16 months. Despite this awful toll, progress is being made to stop their use and protect local communities, thanks to the Mine Ban Treaty, which became international law in 1999. With more on the issue of landmines and what's being done to eradicate them, here's Ruth Bottomley, Landmine Monitor contributing editor.
So in terms of casualty numbers, in 2020, the Landmine Monitor recorded that there were over 7,000 casualties, of which 2,400 people were killed and around 4,500 injured. And I think it's important to say that the vast majority of these casualties are civilians. 80% were civilians where their status was known. And children also accounted for half of all these civilian casualties where we knew what the age was. So landmines continue to create fear. They continue to create death and injury. And this, of course, then has longer-term impacts on people's lives if they're disabled, but also on their families and their impact and their ability to make an income.
And just sorry to interrupt there, Ruth, maybe it becomes normal to communities, but if you're afraid of stepping out of your back door and going into the field and planting, well, it must have an impact on you psychologically.
Yes, I think there is a very big psychological impact for people. But as you say, in some countries where there has been contamination for many, many years, so for example, in Cambodia, there has been contamination for over 30 years. And so people do become accustomed to living in contaminated areas. And this can also lead to accidents because they have to farm. They can't not go and tend their crops or plow their fields. And so they take a risk to do that because otherwise they'll have no food to feed their family. I think in areas where the contamination is new, people are much more reluctant to go into contaminated areas and have a much greater fear of the contamination and also sometimes don't know about the contamination.
Can you tell us where the casualties were in the main, most likely Syria as it has been in recent years, but also Afghanistan?
That's right. So Syria, which is actually not a signatory to the mine ban treaty, but they recorded the highest number of annual casualties for the first time since we began reporting on casualties in 1999. So they had, and I'm giving sort of approximate figures here, but 2,700 casualties in Syria. And then the other countries that recorded over 100 casualties per country include Afghanistan, but also Burkina Faso, Colombia, Iraq, Mali, Nigeria, Ukraine, and also Yemen.
Yeah, so it's very widespread, isn't it? And there's also this alarming rise that you've seen, this new trend of non-state armed groups using improvised mines.
Yes, that's correct. There is increasing use. I mean, we've seen this, I think, really since 2015, increasing use of improvised mines by non-state armed groups. And by improvised mines, we mean devices that have been made perhaps from all sorts of different materials. They're not manufactured, although they may be made from manufactured mines, but they're put together almost in a homemade way. And they're often called improvised explosive devices. But if their design allows them to be detonated by a person, they fit under the category of an anti-personnel mine. So that comes under the obligations of the Mine Ban Treaty, and countries that are contaminated by improvised mines must clear those mines and make sure that the populations who are affected by them receive education about the dangers.
Yes. So you've said in your latest Landmine Monitor Report 2021 that 60 countries are contaminated around the world. Maybe you could tell us about how clearance solutions and clearance efforts are going, and also maybe how COVID, the pandemic, has impacted on those.
Yes. So as you mentioned, there are still 60 states that are known or suspected to be contaminated by anti-personnel mines, and also, of course, including the improvised mines that we've just talked about. Clearance is ongoing in many of the countries, conducted by national authorities, but also by international operators. In 2020, around 146 kilometers square of land was cleared, and over 135,000 anti-personnel mines were destroyed, which is significant progress, I think, considering the challenges that have been faced by the countries because of COVID-19 this year. We've seen some good progress in that we have around 33 countries that have announced completion of clearance within their countries. And in 2020, both Chile and the UK announced that they had completed their landmine clearance. And we have, in some countries, Cambodia and Croatia, they cleared a significant amount in 2020, almost 50 kilometers square in each country.
Thank you, Ruth. And finally, let's just talk about the Mine Ban Treaty and progress on signing. And one thing that I didn't know was that you've got dozens, maybe 70 or so non-state armed groups who've signed this. But internationally, how are we doing on this Mine Ban Treaty, which is, what, 20 plus years old now?
So I can't talk personally on the negotiations with non-state armed groups, although it is absolutely a significant achievement. And it's another Geneva-based organization, Geneva Call, that actually does quite a lot of that work. where we are in terms of the treaty, as I said, we've got sort of around 30 countries that have declared that they've completed their clearance, but we still have a large number who have contamination that needs to be dealt with. In 2014, at a review conference in Maputo in Mozambique, state parties agreed that they would intensify their efforts to complete clearance, and this included a commitment to clear all mined areas as soon as possible and to the fullest extent by 2025. And at the moment, you know, if we look at the figures, 24 state parties have deadlines to meet their obligations, their clearance obligations before 2025. But if we look at the details, we can see that very few of these state parties are actually on track to do that. So I think there is going to need to be a concerted effort by all involved to make sure that the commitments are renewed and that progress can be made on clearance so that we have more state parties completing their clearance sooner rather than later.
My thanks to Ruth Bottomley from the Landmine Monitor for explaining the scale of the landmines problem and the progress that's being made to help victims everywhere. Now let me turn to our regular guest, Solange Berhetegui-Cortez, for some closing thoughts. Hi, Solange.
Hola, Daniel. Sofia is a young heroine of two stories written by the Swedish writer Henning Mankell, Secrets in the Fire and Playing with Fire. Every morning, Sofia's mother warms her and her sister Maria. Never leave the path, not even by a meter. Never take shortcuts. But one morning, Sofia and her sister Maria leave the path on the way to school. And boom, Maria dies and Sofia has both of her legs blown off. We just heard that the vast majority of landmines victims are civilians, 80%. But what is even more outrageous is what Ruth Bottomley said to you, Daniel. If you live in a landmine zone, you have to balance all risks. The risk of not having food against the risk of being injured by a landmine. The risk of not going to school against the risk of losing your legs. A landmine doesn't differentiate between a soldier and a civilian, between war and peace. A landmine is something slipping under our feet, just waiting to explode. A landmine deprives people of running and dancing. Landmines are everywhere, an invisible enemy that gets inside you. The American author Ray Bradbury wrote, "Every morning I jump out of bed and step on a landmine. The landmine is me. After the explosion, I spent the rest of the day putting the pieces together." Victims of landmines have a long journey toward recovery. Even with artificial legs, a landmine survivor must learn to walk all over again, to create new paths, safe paths. Until all the countries commit to clear all antipersonal mines in all mined areas, civilians will continue walking blind, and we will still be sitting on a broken chair like the one standing on three legs in front of the UN building in Geneva.
Thank you, Solange. Yes, you can't miss the broken chair, which reminds us about landmine victims right outside the UN here in Geneva in the Place des Nations. We have run out of time again. Thank you, listeners. Thanks also to our intern, Ines Alfaro, who's in the wings with me in the studio, making sure that everything runs smoothly here on tape and online. We'll be back next week with an interview from the Food and Agricultural Organization from Afghanistan, where winter seed is needed desperately, among other things. But don't forget, if you want more headlines, stories and interviews, just check out UNnews.com/audiohub. That's it then. Bye-bye for now.
Ciao, Daniel.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Over the last week, COVID-19 infections have elevated, with 3.6 million cases reported globally, as opposed to 3.3 million in the previous 7 days, the World Health Organization said on Wednesday. In its weekly epidemiological update, the UN Health Agency noted that infections in Europe had increased by almost twice the global average. The announcement followed a WHO warning that Europe could see more than 2 million coronavirus-related deaths by March. In a related development, WHO said that it was up to individual countries to decide whether to vaccinate youngsters against COVID, while also pointing out that serious coronavirus vaccine shortages remain globally. Last month, a UN Health Agency panel said that the benefits of the vaccine outweighed the risks for all age groups. Latest WHO data shows that children under 15 represent only 0.1% of reported global deaths from the coronavirus, which rises to 0.4% for 15 to 24-year-olds. 5 years after a peace deal was signed between the Colombian government and FARC oppositional forces, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged local communities on Tuesday to persevere with their efforts to keep violence at bay. "It costs work to build peace and take care of it and sustain it," Mr. Guterres told residents of Dabieba in the northern town of Llano Grande. He added, however, enemies of peace remain. Since 2017, more than 300 former combatants have been murdered, and almost 500 rights defenders and civic leaders have died in violent attacks throughout the country. Mr. Guterres said he admired the tenacity and commitment of the people who continue to bet on building peace in Colombia on a day-to-day basis. He also warned that ensuring their security is vital to consolidating peace. UN Special Envoy Hans Grunberg wrapped up an official visit to Cairo on Wednesday as part of the ongoing bid to bring an end to fighting in Yemen. In a statement, Mr. Grunberg's office said that he had held meetings with the Egyptian Foreign Minister and the Secretary General of the League of Arab States. His diplomatic push for peace comes amid renewed serious concern for the people of Yemen's northern Marib region. The UN Migration Agency, IOM, warned in a new alert that active front lines have shifted more in the past 2 months than at any time this year. This has forced yet more people to flee their homes in the oil-rich region, many for the fourth or fifth time, with more than 45,000 people displaced since September, according to IOM data. A warning now that we may soon reach a tipping point when antimicrobial resistance becomes the leading cause of death, surpassing heart disease and other so-called lifestyle illnesses. According to the Food and Agricultural Organization, the wide use of antibiotics and other antimicrobials has led to growing resistance to their effectiveness. It is estimated 700,000 people die from AMR-related causes each year, and that could soar to 10 million by the year 2050 if no actions are taken. To help mitigate and contain the risks, these drugs must be avoided and prevention measures must be taken, Keith Sumpton, FAO's chief veterinary officer, said. Based on his doctoral research in southern Africa, Dr. Sumpton suggested giving livestock and crop producers clear alternatives. This includes good animal hygiene, nutrition and good soils, as well as good genetic selection. High-income countries could also help less developed countries take a more progressive approach to crop protection while providing resources to encourage farm-level biosafety and biosecurity. The use of alternatives to antibiotics, such as vaccination, probiotics and prebiotics in feed, may reduce the likelihood of AMR. The goal is not to eliminate antimicrobials, but to preserve their utility, said Dr. Sumpton. Katie Dartford, UN News.
This is Liz Cafidi with UN News. Despite the ongoing war in Yemen and the devastating humanitarian consequences, there is still hope for recovery within a generation, the UN Development Program, UNDP, said in a report published on Tuesday. The report outlines how ending the conflict, combined with inclusive policies, including greater investment in women, could lift Yemen out of poverty and put it back on the path to achieving the Sustainable Development Goals. Auka Lutsma, UNDP representative in Yemen, was in New York and spoke to Diane Penn ahead of the launch.
This report is actually a third report in the trilogy. We've brought out two reports before that also describe the situation in Yemen. And with this third report, we wanted also to show that although Yemen is still in a very bad situation as a cause of the conflict, there are ways, there are pathways that could help Yemen to get out of the current crisis that it's in if peace was come tomorrow. So the report as such makes a very important point about the war has to stop now to end the suffering in Yemen. At the same time, it would also facilitate, I would say, different pathways, but certainly pathways that could help Yemen to catch up with the development trajectory it was on before. And in fact, if everything would fall in place, they could even beat the trajectory that they were on before as well, and actually making significant progress towards the SDGs.
And like you just said, UNDP believes Yemen can get back on the path to sustainable development. However, and as you mentioned, this is dependent on a peace deal. And you say if this peace deal were to come into effect from next year, why do you believe this is possible? I mean, next year is just a couple of weeks away.
Absolutely. Of course, important developments are going on in the country in terms of the military developments as well, but at the same time also a number of countries, but also the UN itself, is exerting a lot of efforts to bring a settlement on the table that could be looked at by both parties. And I'm a firm believer that peace is always around the corner. What you really need is the will of the parties to sit together and come to a resolution. And that in itself will then help us also to help the country back on its feet, first of all, but also work towards a better future for all Yemenis in terms of, you know, giving them hope, but also dignity for a better future.
Now, tell us about the cost of this recovery, because it's going to be a lot in terms of not just money, but also in investing in people.
Absolutely. Of course, recovery and reconstruction in Yemen will never be cheap. The country has gone now through 6-7 years of war with a lot of death and destruction that occurred during this period. So it is very clear that a significant investment will need to take place. What we're saying with this report is that not only a significant investment is needed, and the World Bank estimated this would be at least a $25 billion effort, what is also needed is the right policies to ensure that we leave no Yemeni behind and really are taking into account the whole context of SDGs to put this country back on its feet and giving it a viable future for the decades to come.
Could you tell us about some of those policies?
Absolutely. What is really important, I think, for Yemen is, first of all, to address some of the deep development deficits that it has at the moment. There is a very rapid population growth, which really puts a lot of pressure on its natural resources. Yemen is definitely also one of the most water-stressed countries in the world, and therefore sustainable water management, you know, also in response to climate change, is going to be extremely important. Yemen is one of those countries that will suffer the most from climate change. In fact, it is expected that by 2050 the temperature will rise to at least 3 degrees for what it is today. So you can imagine in a desert-like country like Yemen what impact that may have. There are also other development deficits that need to be addressed as well. I think, for example, if you look at gender, I think it's fair to say that Yemen, whatever gender index you look at, it's always at the bottom. So bringing women into the fold, making them part of the labor force, and really empower women also to contribute to the recovery and reconstruction of Yemen is going to be incredibly important. And in fact, the report that we have in front of us exactly makes that point. Involving women will really give a boost to GDP and development in the country.
And let's talk about the time frame now. Of course, you've mentioned the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, and their deadline is 2030. Is it that you're hoping that this process begins in time for the SDGs, or that it's much longer?
I think it is unrealistic to think that Yemen will be completely on track to achieve all the SDGs by 2030. The conflict in Yemen really has become a generational conflict, so its recovery and reconstruction will be also a generational effort. But our report estimates by 2050, so that's sort of in one generation, poverty could be halved and Yemen could really be back on track to become a middle-income country. So it is definitely possible. And in fact, as I mentioned at the outset of the interview, actually it will help Yemen to beat its original development trajectory. So, but again, what is really important is that it will use the right policies to implement its recovery and reconstruction effort.
We'd spoken about the cost in terms of financing and investment, but I guess there's also a greater cost, too, that if we don't do this, the country would not be anywhere near any chance of achieving any type of development goal. I wonder if you can speak about how badly or how dire the situation is and why we need to have this now.
First of all, Yemen is still the worst humanitarian and the worst development crisis in the world. We still estimate, as the UN, that 18 million people are dependent on humanitarian aid, and there's about 13 million people that are fed by WFP as we speak. So it really shows you that the situation is really, really difficult. Now, going forward, if we don't act, we've calculated that at the moment, already every 9 minutes a child dies, which is already down from every 12 minutes when we looked at it 2 years ago. So that already shows you how it's still going down. We also estimated that by 2030, if the war is to continue, 1.3 million people will have died from direct and indirect consequences. And I think that's a toll that no country would tolerate, and I think this is also a toll the international community cannot tolerate, and we really have to help Yemenis to find hope and find dignity for a better future.
Thank you. And speaking about that hope and dignity, you know, you're there in the country and on the ground and meeting with Yemenis. Do they feel that this is possible for their country, that these developments can actually be achieved?
Well, I've been now working in Yemen and on Yemen for the last 5 years or even a little bit more, as a matter of fact. And one thing that strikes you when you engage with Yemenis, not only with authorities, but also with communities, with women, you know, that one thing that really strikes you is really the resilience of Yemeni people. Yemen is always known as a resilient country, but when you speak to the people we serve in the country, then it can only, you know, give you even more courage, even more resilience yourself to work on their issues and address the challenges that the country is facing. And that manifests itself in many areas, and specifically also in the projects that we implement in Yemen to help the communities that we work for. I mean, it's just amazing. We have, for example, a woman that became overnight one of the most 100 influential women chosen by BBC. And what she did was basically empowering communities through microsolar grids in the community and really serving a lot of households there and running a business that at the moment has grown to a couple of hundred employees. So it's kind of these examples that give you sort of this idea that, you know, anything is possible in Yemen as long as we give them the chance, and therefore the war has to stop.
The report speaks of, you know, importance of innovation and that Yemen does have innovators in lots of different aspects. It's important to also support this, too.
Yeah. Well, one thing that struck me when we were discussing in how we would put this report together is that, like, how this crisis also has given Yemen an opportunity to build back better. For example, at the moment, you know, there is no electricity grid to speak of. So individual households take care of their energy requirements through putting a solar panel on the roof. That in itself has already spurred, I think, a transformational change in the country, how electricity is being generated. But moreover, it also gives a great opportunity to the country to go to 100% renewable energy supply, because it doesn't exist in the first place, right? So why not jump?
I just leapfrog.
and go ahead and really sort of, you know, the COP26 has brought this out very clearly, how we need to move on to stay climate resilient. So basically, I think this is also an opportunity we could give to Yemen to really get into the 21st century and make this transformational change, for example, in the energy sector.
Mr. Lutzma, thank you so much for taking the time from your busy schedule here in New York to speak to UN News. Is there anything further you think our audience should know about either the report or UNDP's work in Yemen, projects you do, anything along those lines?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that all three reports will be available on the UNDP Yemen website, so they're downloadable, of course, for anybody and for free. But I think the most important thing I'd like to share with the audience is to say, look, there's a lot of competition on the global scale in terms of the attention of the world. And although Yemen is widely considered the worst humanitarian and development crisis in the world, at the same time, it remains also a forgotten crisis. And part of the report and the purpose of publishing it is also to keep Yemen on the radar screen and making sure that it receives the attention that it deserves.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Efforts to reform global pandemic preparedness and response are happening too slowly, the World Health Organization's Independent Panel for Pandemic Preparedness and Response said on Monday. In a new report, former premiers of New Zealand and Liberia, Helen Clark and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, warned that COVID-19 has continued to cause illness, deaths and economic losses, thanks to uneven progress in tackling infections. Among their recommendations, the panel called for heads of state and government to make faster progress, especially at the UN General Assembly. A new leader-led Global Health Threats Council should also be launched to provide much-needed leadership and accountability, the independent panel said. Much of the groundwork for reforms has been done, it noted, adding that it was imperative to end this pandemic and prepare for the next global health threat. UN-appointed independent human rights experts have urged China to release on humanitarian grounds imprisoned citizen journalist and human rights defender Zhang Zan. Her health is deteriorating rapidly and she can no longer walk unaided, the experts said on Monday. Failure by the Chinese authorities to act swiftly and effectively could have fatal consequences for Zhang Zan, they warned in a joint statement, before calling for her immediate and unconditional release along with medical treatment. The rights experts, who are appointed by the Human Rights Council, said that Ms. Zhang had been detained in Shanghai since May 2020. She is serving a four-year sentence and was originally arrested after posting a video online that criticized the government's handling of the COVID-19 outbreak. The arrest and detention of Zhang Zan and a number of other citizen journalists reporting on the outbreak of COVID-19 in Wuhan, a matter of vital public interest, is deeply troubling, the experts said, noting that they are in contact with the authorities on the matter. Over the past decade, the Hungarian government's stranglehold of the media poses a threat to human rights during the upcoming elections, warned a UN-appointed independent rights expert. Following an official visit to the country, UN Special Rapporteur Irene Khan warned that authorities have reshaped the sector by funding pro-government media that ostracizes critical voices. Ms. Khan called for the safeguarding of editorial freedom and access to diverse sources of information, while also expressing serious concerns at reports of hate speech, harassment or stigmatization of journalists and human rights defenders who work with migrants, refugees and the LGBTI community. Katie Dartford, UN News.
This is Anna Karmu with UN News. Aquatic foods, a key source of protein, micronutrients and essential fatty acids, are superfoods, which when added to a diverse diet of vegetables, fruits and pulses, such as beans, peas and lentils, contribute to cognition, health and nutrition. In an interview with UN News, 2021 World Food Prize laureate Shakuntala Haraksingh Tilstead explained the important role that fish and aquatic food systems have in sustainable healthy diets and how they should be included in nutrition policies and program interventions to tackle malnutrition, noting an urgent need to shift the global narrative from simply feeding people to nourishing a growing population. Dr. Tilstead, a steering committee member of a high-level food panel with UN Committee on World Food Security, began by telling UN News' Sachin Gawood how her research approach has led to this award.
My approach was people-centered, nutrition-sensitive approaches, which looked at improving nutrition and health with specific focus on women, pregnant and lactating women, and young children, the first 1,000 days of life. This approach, I would say, it's moving the narrative and moving the work that we do from a focus on feeding to moving the debate and moving the narrative to nourishing people, which takes, of course, quantity into consideration, but as well as quality, nutritional quality and food safety. So using a food systems framework that takes into consideration not just production, as many do from agriculture, but looking at starting with consumption and working back to supply chains and to production systems. Being in Bangladesh, I work, the diet in Bangladesh is rice and vegetables and fish, and then zoned in on fish because of this age-old Bangladeshi proverb, you know, Mashibati Bengali, which means fish and rice make a Bengali, and I was always interested in why, when rice was so important in that part of the world, that fish was placed first. And in talking with women and also talking with professionals, then they would tell about the value of fish in the diet, and women would make this connection that when there is water, when there are rains, when the rains come, they see better. And, you know, you would think about what's that connection. But the connection is with the rains, with the water, come fish. And when they eat more fish, then they get more vitamins, and vitamin A in particular, which benefits their eyesight. With the diversity of fish species, there's a diversity of nutrient composition of fish species. and combined with other nutrition sensitive approaches like nutrition education, social behavior change communication, you would then, it had multiple wins because you would be increasing production, thereby increasing more sale and thereby household income, and at the same time promoting consumption within the household. I was able to move these approaches to many different countries in Asia and Africa and even in the Pacific. And by shifting this approach from feeding to nourishing, that is what made the change and got many people, governments and the private sector and others, to come on board.
Well, of course, you gave an example of Bangladesh. Your work is relevant in so many different areas and regions. And yeah, we all know that producing enough food and ensuring nutrition for a growing population, some estimates suggest 9 billion by 2050, it's a huge global challenge. Why do we also need to focus on fish and aquatic foods in boosting global food and nutrition security? Why fish? Why aquatic food?
Because they are superfoods in terms of their micronutrient content and essential fatty acids. And not only that, I mean, if you look at a global level, many poor and vulnerable people, the data that's given is over 800 million people depend on fisheries for their, as the most important source of livelihoods. And a lot of the problems that we are facing today sometimes is around the quality of food, not just the quantity of food. And in this respect, I do think, you asked me about aquatic foods, I do think what's important, well, aquatic foods as being one of the group of foods that should be on the plate of food. So fundamental in moving forward, we should be thinking about diversity of foods and diversity of nutritious foods. So that includes aquatic foods, it includes vegetables, it includes fruit, it includes pulses, and not just the focus on the staple food, which in other parts of, you know, India, in Bangladesh is rice, or in Africa is maize. So diversity is important, and what diversity brings with it, it brings with it diverse nutrients and essential micronutrients. It brings with it essential fatty acids. For example, B12 is extremely important for cognition, for growth and development, for health and nutrition of adults. If we would be able to nourish the child from birth or even before birth with a pregnant and lactating woman and then the child growing up, then you would get intergenerational benefits. A healthy child grows to be a healthy adult, better school performance, better work performance, and contribution to national development. And in the part of the, like you take Asia, it's not like in Western countries, in European countries, when you would eat fish or aquatic foods, you eat it, you know, it's singular, a piece of muscle on the plate. You eat in Asia, it's cooked in a recipe with spices, with vegetables. So the aquatic foods bring with it other nutritious foods. So there are multiple benefits. You have nutrients in vegetables and in rice. You talk about high iron millet or high zinc rice. But if you would have a little bit of aquatic foods on the plate together with these plant source foods, the aquatic food enhances the absorption of micronutrients from the plant source foods. So you have a complementarity effect. In general, what we should be aiming for is a plate of sufficient food, but those foods should be diverse. And the diversity should be of nutritious foods, not just the staple food. If you would look at some of the life cycle analyses, some fish species are termed to have lower carbon footprint and greenhouse gas emissions than terrestrial animal source foods, such as beef and pork and chicken. So you are getting multiple wins from that.
Transformation of global food systems was a key theme during the recent UN Food Systems Summit. How can we achieve this, particularly in the context of aquatic food systems?
Transformation of food systems is something that everyone is talking about, because the phrase that is used, our food systems are broken. They are not serving the purpose of healthy people and healthy planet. And this goes back to what I said, that where we started in working with food systems, the majority of the focus was on staple foods, rightly so. But now we must move. I mean, we have issues of obesity, rising obesity in adults and in children, all in all parts of the world. We have micronutrient deficiencies, cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, which are all impacted by the diets that we eat. So we have to move the food systems so that it can take into account these multiple challenges. And one of the ways that I think the shift we can make is moving just to food, land, and water systems. We have been very focused on food, and in that respect, few foods and land systems. But if we would move it to diverse foods, to land and to water systems, where we look at the foods that are from waters, both marine waters and inland waters, and just not fish. Fish is just a small part of those foods. You have plants, animals, and microorganisms. Take, for instance, seaweed. Then you would get a greater diversity of foods. And at the UN Food Systems Summit 2021, the scientific group that to the UN Food Systems Summit, they named 7 priorities for action. And one of those priorities was on aquatic foods. Another solution that was given was school feeding should be a priority. And this was also with respect to the disruptions we are seeing now with COVID-19 and more people not getting enough nutritious foods. And this is one way that they think they can meet some of the needs is by focusing on school feeding. So one of the things that what if we would combine these with nutritious aquatic foods together with the school feeding program? For generations, we've had school milk as part of school feeding programs. What if we can, for example, use a product like seaweed, which is so highly nutritious and also with a low carbon footprint, and use this as part of school feeding programs? I do think if we think differently and look at different combinations of solutions, we can get much further than where we are today.
I believe you are also a steering committee member of the UN Committee on Food Security. Tell us about your association with the UN agencies and how you are working with, particularly with the Food and Agricultural Organization to put a spotlight on aquatic food systems in the global action agenda.
In the UN Food Systems Summit, I was vice chair of Action Track 4, which is on equitable livelihoods. And the focus there was on women, youth, and indigenous peoples. There was a lot of work with the UN organization. With FAO, it's quite natural that I have a large engagement with FAO, because FAO has a very strong department for fisheries and aquaculture, and at the same time, a very strong department for food systems and nutrition. And I work in that interface. So that's extremely, so we work a lot. And you know, next year is going to be the year of artisanal fisheries, and called IYAA, or thing. It's about artisanal fisheries, small scale fisheries. Within the UN organizations, there's also the UN Nutrition. And this year, the UN Nutrition, which is the conglomerate of UN agencies and some member states, we've written the first discussion paper on the role of aquatic foods in sustainable healthy diets. And that has been extremely important in moving the agenda and in feeding into the UN Food System Summit. Importantly, I sit in the HLPE, the High Level Panel of Experts in the World Food Security Committee. And that is also an important agenda. And we have been able to do quite a lot there because the HLP is a 15-member organization of experts from across the world. One of the things in choosing the 15 members, you represent different parts of the world. And it's a science policy interface for food systems and food and nutrition security. And the HLP provides evidence-based and scientific reports. So, for example, extremely important reports on food systems, food and nutrition security. This year, we released a report on youth in agriculture. And next year, there's going to be a report on data in agriculture. So it's an extremely important, I would say, committee that meets, discusses, and able to feed into important and global agendas such as the UN Food System Summit. So that's important, and it's also important that the HLPE can monitor now the progress and the implementation of solutions that stem from the UN Food System Summit, so it can go on to 2030 and beyond.
Control, eradication, control, eradication. The experts repeat themselves, but they have to repeat themselves, for this is a fight against time. Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. No, not merely the absence. Here, as elsewhere, we cannot afford to be negative. We cannot go back to the old days.
That's the British actor Michael Redgrave at the microphone in 1958, highlighting the core philosophy on which the World Health Organization, WHO, was founded and to which it still aspires today. I'm Omar Musni, and welcome to another classic podcast from the vaults of our unique audiovisual archive here at UN headquarters in New York. Everyone everywhere has a right to benefit from health services they need without sacrificing other life necessities. And everyone can play a part on the path to universal health care. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus addressed the issue immediately upon his election as WHO Director General.
At present, only about half of the world's people have access to health care without impoverishment. This needs to improve dramatically.
Indeed, on the occasion of World Health Day, the WHO data make it clear billions around the world are still missing out on basic services, while 100 million are being pushed into extreme poverty due to crippling healthcare costs. But as we're about to hear in this UN Radio, WHO, and BBC collaboration, enormous progress had already been made in the Health Watchdog's first 10 years and continue 60 years later. Listen now as 10 Steps Forward takes us backwards in time to when disease ran rampant in the streets of even the most advanced societies on Earth.
Death carts in the streets, red crosses of warning on the doors, corpses tumbled naked into the plague pits. That was London in 1665.
Bring out your dead! Bring out your dead!
Epidemiological Bulletin of the World Health Organization's Top. Section 1, this is today. And the World Health Organization, created just 10 years ago to keep watch on the health of the world and to deal, among many other things, with such epidemics as that in 1947. Send off the following telegram to the Pasteur Institute in Paris, the Lister Institute in London,
the Hafkeen Institute in Bombay.
Seen this cable about cholera vaccine? Well, we've just three questions to answer. How much vaccine have we in hand? And how much more can we produce in a week? How soon can we get it to Cairo? It's quite an order.
Motorcycle escorts to LaGuardia Airport, New York. But not this time escorting a very important person, just a very important vaccine. For that was October 1947, and in Egypt, there were 33,000 cases of cholera. But in a few months...
Geneva, February 18th, 1948. Egypt now declares whole country free from cholera.
A victory for the International Guardians of Health. WHO did not yet officially exist, but it was already functioning. And 2 months later, on the 7th of April, 1948, its constitution came into force. At a time when, in the words of its first Director General, Dr. Brock Chisholm,
"We had just come out of a catastrophic world war, which had reminded people that ours was a small planet. Until quite recently, man's environment had been his locality only, his village or town, or at the most his own country. He had learned to live more or less at peace with his own emotions and had contrived to get along with his immediate neighbors. Now that situation had changed entirely. The environment of every person was the whole world, and it was essential to the health of every individual that he develop beyond the capacity to live with his own kind of people only and be able to live with all the kinds of people all over the world. This, and the concept of health, was not just the absence of sickness or of infirmity, but a positive aim was a new sort of idea. That was why we chose the name World Health Organization."
A new sort of idea on a small planet. A planet which is still divided by frontiers, but those frontiers, as ever, can be crossed by the carriers of disease, by rat and bat, by insect and virus. They can also be crossed by an idea, especially by this new sort of idea. In your different countries, you have different problems.
We have roughly 1,500 patients, and we are terribly understaffed. Roughly 8 to 10 male nurses and about 10 or 12 female nurses. Most of the work is done by untrained staff who attend to the general needs of the patient.
That is a mental hospital in Singapore.
The local society for the welfare of crippled children in Lebanon was formed chiefly through the good offices of a Dr. Harfouche. She was rather appalled by the large number of undernourished and crippled children in Lebanon and indeed throughout the whole of the Middle East.
While further east still, in the Punjab in India.
It was a little difficult. At first we had to get cooperation of the village dai or local midwife, and we tried to get her to realize that she needed a certain amount of training.
Training is nearly everywhere a problem. Training of midwives, training of nurses.
It's very difficult to get suitable girls of a good standard of education to be nurses.
So says one of the few women doctors in Iraq.
There's a constant argument that goes on as to what kind of food a child ought to be given at any stage. Also, there's a constant difference of opinion as to the proper kinds of food for mothers after they've been delivered.
That is in Formosa, an island where, in fact...
In fact, in some areas there were no roads at all, and the midwife had to rush along on a bicycle between the rice paddies either side along a path that was scarcely 18 inches wide, and she wobbled along here until she reached a river, and when she reached the river, off she had to come off her bicycle, fling the bicycle over her shoulder, and go across the river as best she could.
Yes, different problems in different countries. But the end is everywhere the same. Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. So runs the first clause in our Constitution. And every year, at the World Health Assembly, East meets West to discuss that aim.
We talk of privileged countries and underdeveloped countries, but in health, there's no one-way traffic. A two-way, a many-way traffic. And we're now controlling it better, with signposts and lights and rules of the road. WHO holds a watching brief, watching and checking and double-checking and warning.
Section 1, week ended 20th July, cholera, Pakistan, Chittagong 1, India, Calcutta 36, stop, smallpox, Sierra Leone, Freetown 5, Sudan, Port Sudan 2, Pakistan, Karachi 2, Lahore 3.
A constant eye for infectious diseases. In these last 10 years, such diseases have rapidly decreased. Look at the historic scourges like cholera, typhus, smallpox, plague, relapsing fever, yellow fever. But WHO is not only concerned with epidemics, it's concerned with your whole life, from the cradle and indeed from before it.
Schlafe, mein Prinzchen, schlaf ein, es ruhen nun Schäfchen und Vögelein.
This cradle song used to be attributed to Mozart. We now know that it was composed by an amateur musician, a doctor of medicine, in Berlin towards the end of the 18th century, when conditions in Berlin and all through Europe were as bad as they are now in the underdeveloped countries. Mothers continually dying in childbirth, children dying at birth or in infancy. Dr. Bernhard Fleiss's lullaby is still sung. Sleep, my little prince, go to sleep. But now, he's more likely to sleep sound. Sleep, come to the eyes of my child. Your uncle, the moon, will enrich your dreams. So Indian mothers sing in Hindi. But they and their children are still surrounded by perils. It is those perils that WHO is combating. The welfare of mother and child is one of its chief concerns. And already in many countries this work is bearing fruit. The child is more likely to sleep sound, the music less likely to break off. After the danger of birth comes the danger of weaning. There is a disease of small children which often leads to death before the child's third birthday. It is well known to Dr. Omondi, one of the few African doctors in Kenya.
In Kenya, there's a great deal of malnutrition, particularly of children who have previously been weaned and have been put to a diet which is deficient in proteins. And since they cannot get that protein, their growth is deficient, and these children are liable to a lot of infections such as bronchopneumonia and chronic malaria and worms. So malnutrition is a real problem in Kenya, which is being faced and which I hope will be under control in some time to come.
Undernourished children and crippled children. There are many of the latter in the Lebanon. Dr. Kraft went out there from Britain a few years ago to start up the first Lebanese center for crippled children.
A number of the children were not only located around Beirut, but at distances from the city. Now, Lebanon, as anybody will know, is a country rather more mountainous than Switzerland. Traveling is extremely difficult. Distances, not so much, but it's the traveling. To get anybody to the center at 6 o'clock in the morning meant leaving at midnight the night before. So we had to make a very large dormitory. This proved wonderfully successful.
So it goes on, watching the mother before and during and after the birth of her child, and watching that child in turn through the years of its growing up. And as it grows up, some menaces fall away, but new ones will take their place. It's the same with countries. As a country becomes more developed, certain diseases decrease, but others acquire a new prominence. For instance, poliomyelitis, that disease which can cripple you for life. Dr. A.M. Payne from Geneva has followed and taken part in the campaign against polio since the Second World War.
During and after the last World War, there had been an alarming increase in poliomyelitis in some countries. And this was very disturbing because at that time there was no prospect of being able to do anything about it. But the real breakthrough came in 1949 when Enders and his colleagues discovered that the virus could be grown in tissue culture. This completely altered the prospects of controlling the disease because it opened the possibility of being able to manufacture a vaccine against the disease.
Such a vaccine was manufactured, what is known as an inactivated vaccine. But hopes are now being placed on something more active, more sweeping, a live virus vaccine which will strike at the roots of this disease.
Trials of the live virus vaccine are now going on in the United States, the USSR, the Netherlands, Mexico, South Africa, and they're also being planned in a number of other countries. But meanwhile, of course, considerable success has been recorded in the United States in recent years in reducing the incidence of polio through the use of the Salk vaccine.
But there are other diseases. The malaria, the disease which may have killed Alexander the Great and later destroyed the Roman Empire. A disease which is carried by mosquitoes and can spread like wildfire. In the words of Dr. P.F. Russell, a WHO consultant.
So it goes on and on, mosquito to man to mosquito to man, until almost everyone in a community has the disease. Probably 200 million persons were infected with malaria in this way in 1955. Those who have malaria naturally become anemic. They lack vitality and ambition, can't farm or work properly, can't provide for their families, get into debt, or maybe die prematurely. Without doubt, malaria is bad for an individual, bad for a community, and bad for a nation.
In the middle 1930s in Ceylon, the malaria death roll was enormous. 10 years later, they took to DDT, and within 3 years, the death rate was down by 82.5%. Ceylon was rightly proud of this achievement. The mosquitoes, it was thought, were defeated. But in regard to malaria, the word control is already out of date. On October the 7th, 1954, a report was received at WHO headquarters. It came from a Greek doctor, Peter Issaris, leader of the malaria team in Indonesia.
On the north coast of Java, DDT resistance has appeared in Anopheles sundaicus.
Which meant that everyone had to think again. Anopheles sundaicus is a malarial mosquito, and according to this report, to this bombshell, it was breeding itself immune to insecticides. This meant that within a few years, this new breed of resistant mosquitoes would have multiplied to the point where it would menace mankind. So the World Health Assembly of 1955 made a very bold resolution. They resolved to eradicate malaria. And WHO now has a division of malaria eradication. Its director is Dr. Pampana of Italy.
Well, I think that now you can say that the present policy of WHO is no longer control, but eradication. And as Siakot Mudaliar said in 1957 at the World Health Assembly,
we in India are particularly interested in this program because for many years we have been fighting this scourge of malaria. And I am glad to note from the Director General's report that more and more countries are now coming to believe that the proper way of controlling malaria is not by control but by eradication.
Control, eradication, control, eradication. The experts repeat themselves, but they have to repeat themselves, for this is a fight against time. And there are other things, too, in this strange new world of ours, which involve a fight against time. Did you expect a clock? No. Those are Geiger counters, which represent a new kind of energy and involve a new attitude to time. This, people say, this is the atomic age. And for better or worse, they are right. And WHO, on behalf of one and all of you, is trying to bring this all-important question into the sphere of the knowable and controllable. Dr. I.S. Eve, who is now in the Director General's office of WHO at Geneva, was previously medical officer at Windscale. It was a logical transfer. His subject is radiation protection.
One of the most important things we think we can do in this subject of protection is training. We are anxious that knowledge of protection measures shall spread across the earth as rapidly as the spread of atomic energy itself. Sir Henry Cowan, Chief Medical Officer of the Department of Health for Scotland, has made a very interesting statement at the last World Health Assembly.
The future of the population of the world is indissolubly linked with the development of sources of nuclear energy. Exploitation of new sources of energy, which will flow and develop from the first halting steps in the use of fission processes, can bestow ineffable benefits on mankind. The evolution of these processes can be left to the nuclear physicist, but the hazards are the concern of the biophysicist and the health worker.
The hazards are the concern of all of us. There they go again. The clock of the atomic age. The life pulse of one and all of you. And to some of you, this pulse seems feverish. The thought of it adds to your nervous strain. But your nervous strain, your mental health, is also the concern of WHO. You remember that first clause, first challenge, first statement of faith? Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. No, not merely the absence. Here, as elsewhere, we cannot afford to be negative. We cannot go back to the old days.
Ring out, you're dead.
No, you're living. Take off that tolling bell. We must bring out our living. Living in every sense, physically, mentally, socially. This small planet is big with the future. And that future will live in our children, and that future itself is like a child, and it has many possibilities. Some of them we have mentioned today, but there are many others which are on the agenda. The agenda of World Health Organization.
That was an edited version of 10 Steps Forward, narrated by British stage and screen actor Michael Redgrave to mark the 10th anniversary of WHO in 1958. As he said, the WHO agenda includes many topics and has since expanded to address such issues as substance abuse, road safety, and clean energy, among others. That's it for this edition of our podcast classics series. You can find a wealth of other audio, film, and video by going to www.unmultimedia.org/AVLibrary. This unique collection of material goes back to the 1940s and the founding of the United Nations. I'm Omar Musni, and thanks for listening.